I will have to collect it all from you, because it's out of my pocket if you don't do it. So the only person that's going to get ripped off is me. If you want to rip me off, don't pay. And I will set fire to your car. The other thing is, I don't know when the registrar is insisting on having grades turned in for spring session. I used to know, but I forgot. But what I recall is that it's pretty quickly after the course ends. And there's going to be a lot of trouble if you don't turn the stuff in when it's due. Because I am going away for 10 days on the 28th or 9th. And although in the past there were ways of fiddling around, things have tightened up considerably, so that now if you don't have a grade to turn in when they're due, the person has to have a certificate from various medical authorities certifying that they were unable to do the work. So let's put it this way. Don't turn things in later than Wednesday the 23rd, even if you have to turn in something that's undone, okay? I'd rather see your rough draft and some notes towards this paper you were trying to finish but couldn't, than nothing at all. Because nothing at all is a zero, right? A bunch of notes is probably 40%, so I mean, give yourself a break. Just, you know, crumpled up pieces of paper is better than nothing. Yeah, bits of hair, coffee, you know, pour coffee on it, crumple it up, turn it in a plastic bag, and say, that's what I can do, right? But whatever you've got, you got to turn it in on time, because otherwise there's going to be all this complications with late stuff, which I'm going to be forced to call not turned in or incomplete. So, okay. That's it for administration. So, all these things you turn in, I intend to put outside my office and can pick them up starting the following week. Paper 2 I didn't get done. You should have it next time. Yeah, that I should bring to class next time. 2020-2040. Three short papers, 20%. The longer paper, 40%. That's it. Okay, good. So, let's plunge right in, because today we get to roar through the Louvre on a motorcycle. We're going to go from Newton to Locke to Smith to Darwin to Marx. Easy if you have a roadmap. So let's start with Newton, where we began to talk last time. The thing that we want to see is the way in which Newton, one way of looking at this is to say there's a public Newton and a private Newton. Another way to look at it is to see that there's two kinds of questions Newton thinks he's dealing with. But what we need to notice, first of all, is the way in which Newton and the Newtonians, like Clark, who writes the preface to the second edition of the Principia, Samuel Clark, with Newton looking over his shoulder, the way in which Newton and the Newtonians argue for this business of positive knowledge, science as positive knowledge. The prime example of which is the force of gravity. The kind of thing Newton is arguing, that there is such a force that it's exerted between any two masses. Its magnitude is proportional to the product of those masses and inversely proportional to the square of the distance between them. This is something Newton has deduced from phenomena. I mean, basically what Newton does is And here's where he invents the calculus, okay? Here's a point P. All right, now let's imagine a little body with mass little m, and it's drifting along all by itself, doing what it likes in a straight line at constant speed. So it's obeying the first law of motion. This is what it does when you leave it alone. Okay? Now Newton says, let's pretend that when it gets to here, we bang it with a little hammer. Ping. Instantaneous force. And we'll bang it towards this point P. Okay? Now this will have the effect of, we don't want to hit it too hard. We're going to hit it in such a way that we sort of change the direction of the thing so it's now gone like this. Okay? It would have gone like this, but we tapped it. Okay? Now it's going to go like this. From here on in, we're going to tap it with this little hammer at equal intervals of time. And whatever the magnitude of this first tap, bang, all successive taps will be harder or softer in inverse proportion to the distance P to the object. We start out with just an arbitrary bonk, but thereafter at equal time intervals we're going to bonk it, but the relationship between the initial bonk and all successive bonks has to be larger or smaller in inverse proportion to the square of that distance. So if we get twice as close, if it's twice as close when I hit it, I gotta hit it four times as hard. Okay? Alright, so I go bonk, and the thing is now drifting along in this direction, but I let that amount of time pass and I go bonk again. So it's not going that way. I should draw this differently. Otherwise it's gonna look a bit goofy. The dotted lines. It was going to go that way, but now I bonked it, so it's going this way. And I let another interval of time go, same interval of time. And I bonk it again, and so now instead of going this way, it's going this way. And I let an interval of time go again, and I bonk it quite a bit harder because it's quite a bit closer. And I divert it again. So it's done this, now it's doing this, and I bonk it again, so now it's doing this, and you see what's happening, right? Now, well, it's just... Now notice what I can do if I'm very good at mathematics. I can let the time between these hits get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. So instead of bonk, 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 it's bonk, 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 bonk. And as that time gets smaller and smaller and smaller, this interval shrinks to nothing, and the bonks go from staccato to a smooth force. It just smooths right out into a continuous force acting towards P on this little mass, and the force is varying as the inverse square of this distance. In other words, this is an imitation of a gravitational force, if there were such a thing. You know what Newton is able to prove? And this is a proof. I mean, you may think Paracelsus is the only guy in town with any brains in his head, but this is proved. In any possible world that's like this is true, okay? What Newton is able to prove is that when you smooth this out into a continuous curve, this curve has to be a conic section. It has to be a parabola or an ellipse, and that's the beginning and the end of it, or a circle, which is a special case of an ellipse. Now, you can imagine when Newton's able to prove this, how astonished or excited he might be. Because we have Kepler, having wrestled with all this intractable data showing that the planets are all doing ellipses, of which a circle is a special case. And we have Galileo having shown that that's a parabola, if you consider this as flat. That's a parabola. So bingo! The planets, the piece of chalk, the apple, all that stuff, are just masses being acted on by forces directed towards other masses. Here we are near the Earth, so the biggest mass around is the Earth itself, in comparison to which the mass of that tree over there is not noticeable. And so all these heavy things are acting like bodies which obey the first law of motion and are moving in such a way that as if they are being acted on by a force towards the center of mass of other masses, and that force is one that has this kind of magnitude. Bingo. So, remember also last time Newton checks it out with the moon and finds that the acceleration on the moon is roughly 1/3600 of the acceleration on the apple. Remember, the moon and the apple fall together. If you have an apple up there in orbit, it would be going the same speed as the moon and having the same acceleration on it. A much smaller force, because the apple is much smaller. And Newton also knows that the moon is about 60 Earth radii away, so here we have a check that the force falls off as 1 over 60 squared. So this is dandy, and the Newtonian synthesis, if you want to put it that way, are these laws of motion which unite terrestrial motion and celestial motion under one set of physical laws. Parabolas, ellipses, and so on and so forth. There's one kind of matter, there's one set of laws of motion, and that accounts for everything terrestrial and celestial there is. Now, you'll remember several places in which we see, this is particularly the case in Coates' preface to the second edition of the Principia, that Newton is falling under some criticism for engaging in hypothesizing occult powers, hidden powers. I mean, look at this gravity. There's a force acting on this thing. It's measurable. It's quantified. You find out what these are from, I mean, remember, force is in part defined by the magnitude of the force for any given mass is proportional to the rate at which the thing is having its state of motion change. Well, there's a proportionality constant to get the thing, to get the dimensions right. To get the dimensions right, you've got to have a constant in there. For any given acceleration, the magnitude of the force is proportional to the mass. For any given acceleration. So, something twice as massive as something else has to be pushed twice as hard as something else. So, in the second law, I'm basically defining what a force is. A force is the name of that power which changes the state of motion of masses. Given that, then I know what I'm talking about here when I'm talking about masses and forces. Okay. Who do you think would be criticizing Newton? I don't mean who specifically, but you might think of someone specifically. But if there are people criticizing Newton and his fans for engaging in mystical talk about occult powers. I mean, here's this force of gravity is acting through space, without any intermediary, at a distance, who do you think would be saying that this is a kind of reversion to medieval superstition, Aristotelian nonsense, and Paracelsian mysticism? Where do you think that kind of criticism would come from?
Church.
Why the mechanical philosophers, the Cartesians? Why? Not Leibniz.
Leibniz criticized Newton for just this.
But for a slightly different reason. But you're right, in part Leibniz is in on that, but he's in a more interesting way. Why the mechanical philosophers, the Cartesians? Why?
I read it this afternoon. Descartes was explaining, he came down with all there is space, bodies themselves have no properties except those.
Except extension.
And yet, with the Newtonian view, the bodies themselves have an innate force within them called gravity in this case. And so it's supposed to be against the Cartesian philosophy.
Well, we talked about the mechanical philosophy, of which Descartes is a difficult example. Boyle is a little easier because he's just doing pool table stuff. No action without contact. That's the point. The laws of motion are all of them, except for the first law, laws of collision or pressure. There's no action without contact. Right? So this business of forces acting through a void across immense spaces, this is occult hidden powers. Now, you remember, now, small aside about Leibniz, who I would like to understand a lot better than I do, but Leibniz is in here, I mean, there is a very famous exchange of letters between Leibniz and Samuel Clarke, Newton's flunky. And they're arguing about the status of this and about much else besides. But I gather, I mean, the way I would sum up what Leibniz is concerned about, in a way, comes back to Newton's conception of matter, because what Leibniz is focusing in on is the business of here's this massive thing, okay? Remember, Galileo says, poised and indifferent between the state of moving or resting. Newton is showing, or let's put it this way, his physics hangs together just because force, quantity of force, is a measure of the quantity of matter. More force, the greater the acceleration, the greater the change in the state of motion. The less force, the less the change. And this body, which, in one sense, for the mechanical philosopher, is poised and indifferent. It's dead mechanical matter, remember? What Leibniz wants to point out is this body resists its being changed. Resists the activity that changes its state of motion, that is, it pushes back at you. It's not indifferent. It's not dead mechanical matter. It resists. If it were really dead mechanical matter in that Galilean sense, then presumably even the smallest force could give it even the greatest motion. Force would not be a measure of mass if this were just dead mechanical stuff. So what Leibniz is wanting to push to is what's really here, the most fundamental thing that's here in matter, is force. Some kind of force is here. This is activity. And it displays itself whenever you bug it. It acts. It acts back at you. Now, that's not the bulk of what the Leibniz-Clark correspondence is about. It's about all kinds of things, and I'm having trouble remembering, so it's just as well we don't talk about it. But I am indicating Leibniz's critique is not just that of a Cartesian who's worried about his concept of space as absolute and independent of matter, but also he's concerned about even the particular kind of mechanical philosopher's account of matter as dead and indifferent. As you'll see when we say more about Newton, Newton in one sense acknowledges this problem, and just to let you know that although Newton's very smart, there are always difficulties. In earlier versions of proofs like this, and in some versions actually published in the Principia, though Westphal argues pretty cogently that they are just sort of slips, when Newton sets this up to consider proofs like this, he regularly talks about this body, B, which we're supposed to understand is going in a straight line at constant speed, right? And we're good Galileans, so we know this is just a state of being, right? It's identical to rest, right? Da-dum-da-dum-da-dum. Newton says, body B moving in a straight line at constant speed, carried along by its vis in situ. And it's in Latin, so you have to start making Latinist remarks, but he uses an ablative of agency here. So he definitely means an agent, and what he's doing is being an Aristotelian. He's saying, here's a thing moving in a straight line at constant speed, something must be moving it. Yeah. So it has an innate force that is carrying it along, and this force expresses itself, for example, when you try to stop it. It goes poof at you. There's Carol. Sure, anytime's fine. Does anybody have questionnaires? Do you have one somewhere?
No.
Oh, okay. Any others?
I can't remember. This is my second visit, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Is that it now? No others to come?
Well,
I have one other question.
Yeah, some people were ill last week or away or something, so there's a few. There will still be more, but I'll be happy to take them and give them to them.
Would you?
Sure.
Okay.
Unless you want to, you can come back all you want. At some point, it must get tedious.
At some point, yeah, exactly. Okay, just an account of the mail. The address is on the front of the envelope.
Well, I'll put them all in one big one.
Carol.
So I'll send them to you.
Good.
Okay. You bet. So there are these kind of problems underneath all of this, how to think about it, how to conceive of it, how to talk about it. But Newton wants to say, hold it. We know what a force is. A force is the name of that agent that changes the state of motion of something, changes the momentum of something. This thing, the planets and the comets, are things describing paths in space which only bodies being acted on by forces would describe, and indeed being acted on by forces that are exactly like this. Okay? So there is a force of gravity. How it arises, I don't know. But that's not, it's the cause of the force of gravity that's hidden, not the force. Yes?
Yeah.
there is something occult here, not the force of gravity, but perhaps its cause. And whether that cause, he says in one place, is material or immaterial, I do not pretend to know. Now, Newton, throughout his active life on this stuff, which stretches from 1664 or thereabouts, right through the 1725-ish, so we're talking like 60 years, Newton tries various ways to get a mechanism, a contact collision mechanism for gravity, and none of them work. None of them work. And he, well, I think, and this is the subject of a book that will be coming out soon by Joe Dobbs, Billy Joe Teeter Dobbs, and I'm not sure what the title is going to be. It's all about Newton's mechanical philosophy, his attempts to get mechanisms. But I think she's going to argue that he ends up convincing himself that a mechanism is impossible in principle, at least a contact collision mechanism. Okay. Now, it seems to me Newton's doing the same thing, though we won't go into it, with the business about white light as a mixture of colored rays. I don't know what a ray is. I don't know what colors are. I don't need to know that. All I need to know, all we need to know is that those rays which are disposed to, rays are the name of the path of light, and those rays which are disposed to cause in you the sensations of different colors, so there's rays coming off of here that make me see blue, and you too, and black and red and so on, that those rays have different refractive indices, are differently refrangible in a given medium, and that white light from like the sun is a mixture of such rays, and to refract them through, say, glass, is to cause them physically to separate. So it's a physical mixture. And we can physically separate them, and we can physically recombine them. And we can show in the crucial experiment that that's what's right, because if we take a prism and physically separate them, then we can stick another board up with a little hole in it and let just the orange ray through, stick another prism up, and that orange ray will stay orange. If Newton wants to argue colors are being caused, brought into being by the interaction of light and matter, then we would expect that orange ray, which means ray disposed to cause you to say orange, we would expect that orange ray on transit through another prism also to produce a rainbow. If what refraction does is bring colors about. You see his argument there. Now, there is a book by a man named Sabra, Abdul Hamid Sabra, called Theories of Light from Descartes to Newton, in which this is discussed extensively, and I think Sabra's argument is correct, that Newton's argument here about deduction from phenomena, white light, a mixture of colored rays, requires for its cogency an assumption or a presupposition that amounts to light is somehow atomic. There's a kind of atomist premise there that's hidden. Because, Sabra argues, and I think he's right, Newton's crucial experiment does not conclusively prove that prisms don't cause colors. because it's perfectly conceivable by a mechanism we don't know or understand that refraction, that white light is a pure thing. Refraction causes a transformation of white light into many colors, a transformation such that further interactions of the same kind do not cause a further transformation, but if reversed, cause a transformation back to the pure original. In other words, a prism might not be a physical separator, but might be a kind of a kind of magical transformer. I mean, roughly speaking, here comes a complicated wave, and the prism transforms that wave into a stack of simple waves. But essentially, it does a resolution or an analysis. And if you reverse it, it takes that stack of simple waves and transforms it into a complicated wave.
Isn't that just a funny way of saying that Newton's
talking? No. Newton's talking physical separation, not transformation.
Well, yes, but I mean the pragmatic results are all just the same.
Yeah, but that's true for Copernicus and Ptolemy. So
no,
come on, give me a break.
You have a theoretical dead end with this particular thing because...
Ooh, maybe not.
Magic...
Not magic. You might discover that the best theory for refraction is a theory of Fourier transforms. And what the prism is a Fourier machine. And it's taking complicated waves and making a set of sine waves out of them. And it can take a set of sine waves and turn them into a fancy wave. But it's one thing, this fancy complicated wave. So it's a difference in reality if you're a realist about theories. See, Newton, the important thing for Newton is, and to Aristotelian, that white light is not a unity. It's not a unitary pure thing. And color is a corruption of light by matter. It's very important to him that what's going on with refraction is simply separation by refraction. The colored rays are there. Already. They're not being manufactured. And that is a difference in one's conception of what's happening. And all I'm saying is that it's hard to prove that. The alternative theory is what's coming from the sun is a unity, and the prism refraction transforms that unity, changes it. And yes, it's accompanied by all those things that Newton observes, different refractive indices for different colored rays and all that stuff.
Yeah, he talks about two other things. You take five particles of yellow and blue and mix them together.
Yeah.
Here's green, and the yellow and blue is still there. You put them under a microscope. And
oh yeah, that's good. That's
about,
good.
You know, exposing materials to different colored rays and seeing what they reflect.
Yeah. All right, that might be beside the point. But anyway, look, I don't want to go on about this. I just want to indicate that similar kinds of things going on with white light. In fact, I will pause on this one. Whatever else, this paper, there it is. This paper is the invention of the lab report. And here it is. If you want to know where did the lab report get invented, this is it. And you'll notice, as I remark in that 4S paper I gave you, in that paper Newton comes on kind of like the Arthur Conan Doyle of the scientific revolution. He's inventing this Sherlock Holmes character who proceeds in this methodical way, right? I mean, just remember the beginning of it. I procured me a prism to try the celebrated phenomena of colors. At first I was diverted by all the pleasing array of colors, but then I stopped that and I got down to work and I went from one thing to the other and I did this and then I did that and this suggested that and then I did that, and it's elementary, dear Watson. Right? Right? Now it's, well, Basil Rathbone did then, somebody did. Now, someone with a flair for these things ought to look into this, because Newton is there writing detective fiction. He did those things, each of them, but not in that order, and not under those conditions exactly. In other words, this is a fairy tale. It's not right. He is presenting you a compelling tale of discovery by rational procedures, right? This kind of scientific, whatever it is. But that ain't the truth. And you can find this out by studying Newton's notebooks and whatnot. There he wishes to indicate to you that he discovers this business about colored white lights, a mixture of colored rays, by these experimental procedures. He doesn't tell you what he could have told you if, for example, he were going to write the kind of scientific paper that Kepler would write. And Kepler would tell you, I woke up this morning, I had a headache, and I had double vision, and I felt awful, and so then I took a walk, and then I sat down and cut. I mean, you know, he tells you just about everything he's doing in the order he's doing it, because Kepler thinks, this is, by the way, why Kepler is a favorite of the Romantics, Kepler thinks you can't know what he knows unless you go through what he went through. You know, there's no artificial insemination for this stuff. You know, you can't read the lab report, you have to. He has to drag you through all the same junk, or else you won't know it the way he knows it. And what he wants to do is give you what he knows, not what some artificial intelligence might know. Anyway, just for example, one of the things Newton doesn't tell you, but he could tell you, is that in 1663 or 4, and this is recorded in one of his commonplace books, he looked at some woven, a piece of, what do you call these things? Yarn. Piece of colored yarn where colors had been spun together. So there was some spinning and dyeing and then more spinning. And in fact, this was one where there was some red yarn and then kind of intermediate area and then blue. Okay? And it's a long. And he's looking at this through a prism. And this is, of course, what he sees. Right? The displacement. The blue and the red separate. Now, here is the differential refrangibility of colors, 6, 7, 8 years before that paper. You know, so he's giving us a fairy tale here, and so what? I mean, so what? Who am I, a cipher, to be pointing this out? The reason it's worth pointing out is Newton is doing something here. It's like Galileo and Galileo's rhetoric. Newton is engaged in some kind of rhetoric here. He, maybe without knowing it, I don't know what circumstances go into it. I don't think Westfall knows, because I don't recall him ever writing or talking about this. But Newton's doing something here. He thinks this is the way to report this stuff. And I'm not sure why he does, because this is almost the first time it happens. Maybe he wants to make it look like geometry. Maybe he wants to make it look like that kind of demonstration. I'm not sure. But what we have is this invention of that kind of fiction about scientific method. Because here he's saying he actually did it. I did this, then I did this, then I did this, and then I thought of this. And somewhere in the back of his head he has to, what's going on? Why isn't there a voice in the back of his head saying, BS! You thought of that 8 years ago. What are you talking about? Then I thought of this. What kind of nonsense is this? Right? It's an interesting puzzle.
sort of packaging
almost. Yeah, what does Newton think he's doing here?
Persuasive.
Well, I think that's obvious. He must think this kind of presentation will carry more authority, will perhaps help to establish a boundary between guys like me, Isaac Newton, and mechanics, crude empirics, Aristotelians, or whatever. In other words, setting that special place for the man of science, right? And it's interesting that it is that right there is this kind of business where he's playing off the sensual pleasure of colors against the cold analysis of colors. And he says it right out. At first I was attracted to the display of colors, and then, you know, it's like... Yeah, he took a cold shower and got... I threw a bucket of water over myself. Why is that there? What's he doing? Is he really trying to say, no emotions, no sensuousness, no, this is the cold intellect? Is that what he's trying to, what's the point?
He might be right.
Well, sure he might be right. That's irrelevant. If he's right, how come now, then? How come Isaac Newton, 1672, London, Cambridge, not, you know, Joe of Barcelona in 1323.
Did Flaubert give you all these copies of Madame Mercury? Did he tell you about all the things he was doing? I mean, you have to have some sort of finished copy. I mean, what he might have chatted about with his friends down at the lab, you know, I mean, I was looking at his yard the other day.
But this is posing. I mean, that, we're into that problem of authenticity. This is an inauthentic report, disguised as an authentic one. In other words, he's saying that he did something that he didn't do, and he's not saying, "Hi, I'm writing a fairy tale called What I Did Last Summer." He's not saying that. He's saying, here's... something's going on here, is what I'm saying. Because he's reporting on
Couldn't
a procedure.
Couldn't it be repeatable? Maybe he's studying it out in such a way that people could repeat it.
That is probably important. That's probably important. And there's a very good discussion of this issue in a book by a guy named Chapin. I forget who else he wrote it with right now. It's called... I haven't seen a copy of this yet, so I don't know what to do with it. Wait till you hear this title. It's called The Air Pump and the Leviathan. And it's about a dispute between Boyle and Hobbes about experiment. And Hobbes is basically saying, for God's sakes, Boyle, you know, after you've snuffed the 49th canary in your stupid air pump, you know, you'd think that'd be enough. What is all this nonsense of all this experimental, empirical, this is just propaganda. So Hobbes is aware that he wants to criticize Boyle about something having to do with experiments and manipulation. And I mean, I think Hobbes is going to come down on the side of all the action is in philosophy. What's going on here with this phony baloney, let's repeat an experiment 86 times? What's going on here? Something illicit. But I don't know quite how it all, don't know quite what Chapin's argument is. But yes, that business of public, you can do it too, that's probably important. But notice, well, maybe this relates to that craftsman business. You can get your own prism, get your own board, get your own sunny day and do it. With a report like, Peter Sim?
Yeah.
Nope, not that I know of. Never has been. Notice with reports like Kepler's, I mean, you do, Tim, to be really stunned by this, you have to be able to say, compare this with Kepler's account of how I got the ellipse for Mars. And it's just painful. But Kepler makes you treat it as a kind of literary thing. You can only participate in this vicariously.
Kuhn reintroduces that. I mean, in offhand comment, yeah. He talks about in science we go through all this training,
yeah.
We're taught to
yeah.
solve problems. We don't
right.
look at the end of the book and solve the problems. But
one of the things that happens in training is you subtly find out that nobody does anything that way, but that's BS.
Yeah.
And that it's okay to break the thing and not tell anybody about it. And it's okay to be really confused and have to massage your data till something makes. You don't have to do it like that. That's part of the glitter or something. Kepler makes you treat what he's doing in a literary way, I think. I mean, you're not...